Thank you for acquiring this teaching series. This series is produced in cooperation with Illumination Publishers International. These audio messages are copyrighted and cannot be copied without the express permission of Illumination Publishers International. At www.ipibooks.com, you'll find other books and audio instructions from teachers around the world that are offered to help you learn and apply God's Word in new and lasting ways. At Illumination Publishers, we are committed to lighting the way to new frontiers in Christian growth. Thanks again for your desire to grow, and contact us at www.ipibooks.com if you have questions or requests.
But anyway, we're really glad to have Foster and Coco teach on a topic. Again, I don't think any one thing you're going to hear today is the answer, but certainly psychological aspects clearly have some bearing, no question about it, on the things that we think of as paranormal. So Foster and Coco, local favorites, one of our greatest supporters in Apologetic Research Society, thank you very much. Come on up, and we'll hear from them now.
Well, it's great to be here, and we have both, I speak for my wife as well, have really appreciated the classes we've already had this morning, and we're going to offer you another angle on some of these phenomena from a psychological perspective. My wife is very well qualified to speak about this. She has an undergraduate degree in psychology and a master's degree in psychology, and currently is a counselor and really coaching and ADD. She has certainly seen a lot, experienced a lot. We were both missionaries in Mexico for a number of years. But anyway, I want to go ahead and let her kick things off with just some general information about the brain and how it works, and how it affects our thoughts and impressions and perceptions. And then I'll take over and discuss a little bit of applied psychology. So let me just hand the microphone over to her. And
Well, thank you so much. I was sharing with my husband how I've got the very difficult job of trying to keep your attention after you've eaten food, and it's late in the afternoon, so part of the brain, this part right here, starts slowing down a little bit and you get sleepy and tired. So if you have gum, chew it. If you have water, drink some. And I'm going to be asking some interactive questions so that I can keep you engaged. Hopefully the information will help as well. So to start out, I just want to show a hands. I want to kind of know my audience and see where you stand. So I'd like to find out who in this group absolutely positively believes that ghosts exist or the paranormal, have had experiences. Okay, that's all right. Absolutely or sure, no doubt. Okay. Now, how many here absolutely positively believe no way? There's just no way. Okay. And how many here are just unsure? Okay, so the majority. All right, well, I fall in that majority with you. You know, I've heard stories like Robert's story, and I completely believe his experience. But my angle is psychological. My background, I studied neuropsychology during my master's program, and I'm fascinated by the marriage of the physical brain and the mind and the thoughts and how that works together. So I will be presenting information. Hopefully it'll help you. My goal for today is for you to actually walk out with something you can use outside of this conference. That's my goal. So I'm going to begin. Okay. Let's see if I can get this to work. Okay, so everything starts with your brain. Your brain is the center of everything. It's an amazing, amazing organ. And your brain, you know, everything that you do, every thought that you have, every function you do starts in the brain. Every single thing that happens from me standing here speaking to you begins with an electrical impulse that sends chemical reactions and makes your body function. So I will focus on that because it is so, so important to understand how that applies to the paranormal, because it does. So there's something called neuron coupling, which is a circuit that you form by the constant practice of whatever thought it is or experience. And as you do that, your brain forms these grooves. So it repeats the same process over and over. And that'll be important as I continue. So, all right. So your brain is made up of 100 billion neurons. 100 billion neurons. And each neuron has 15,000 connections, possibilities, roadways, pathways that it can take. So if you have a pen and you can lift it up, pretend it's a pinhead. Each neuron can hold 30,000 neurons on the tip of a pin. So that's, it measures 4 microns and 30,000 fit on the tip of a pinhead. So all together, all the connections, you know, there's billions of connections. So your brain is an amazing, amazing organ. And the two things I'm going to talk about today is your brain is built to protect and built to detect. That's what it's built for. Under the protection, I'm going to talk about the fight and flight response, which I'm sure you've all heard of, and then two other things called patternicity and schemas. So, all right. So, you know, the brain's number one function, what would you say here is the brain's number one function? Anybody? Survival. That's right. To keep your body alive. That is its function. It is here to make you stay alive. You know, your heart's there to run your blood and keep you circulating. Your lungs are for breathing. Your brain will keep you alive. And that is what it's built for. So your brain is in a constant alert mode. It is constantly looking for danger, for ways to protect you. And of course, the homeostasis, keeping your body in check is, you know, the obvious one. But the one that we don't always think about is the mental part that contributes to, you know, staying and focusing and being alive. So the system that's built in place is a fight or flight response. So if you are in danger, your body will automatically kick in to this fight or flight response. And I'm going to go over the brain parts that are involved. So there's 4 parts of the brain that are involved, the amygdala, the hypothalamus, the hippocampus, and the prefrontal cortex. So those are the 4 areas of the brain that are involved when you feel, detect danger, you know, or you feel threatened. Okay, so we're going to start with the amygdala. The amygdala is these red little almond-shaped things you see up there on the picture. The amygdala is the panic button. It will set the alarm. So the amygdala is the first course of action. So let's say you're walking. I remember being in San Diego. I studied at UCSD. I was going on a prayer walk. And I was walking on the trail, and I saw a snake. And before you could blink your eye, I had jumped 3 feet high, and I was out of there in 2 seconds flat. I mean, I was gone. I didn't even remember thinking. I just saw, and I was out. So this is the panic button. This is the first response. And I put that picture at the beginning of a relay team. You know, I used to run track, and it's like a relay. They one tags the other, tags the other, tags the other, but it all happens in microseconds. So you don't have time to think about it. So that's the amygdala. Okay, the hypothalamus is the part of the brain that starts all the blood pumping, the heart beating, the palms sweating, the dizzy feeling, the lightheadedness if you're really scared, and passing out. So the hypothalamus is the part of the brain that actually gets the physical responses going. Okay, that's that part of the brain. The hippocampus, this is really important. Remember this for later. It's the memory. Okay, I put the flash drives up there in an elephant. This part of your brain will remember what happened. Remember those grooves? You form patterns. So if, for example, I used to work with a group, a support group for anxiety patients, And their anxiety was repetitive. So the same things would cause anxiety over and over and over and over and over again. And this is what it is, because your brain connects the incident and remembers it. And because your brain is built for survival, then instead of wasting time and trying to look through the files, it says, oh, I've been here before. Immediately you feel fear again for the same situation. So this is important, because as you train your brain and it remembers certain incidences or patterns, it will go back to that. So it's important you remember that for later. Okay, and then this is the most important part of the whole thing. It's the prefrontal cortex, this part right here. This part of your brain is called the CEO of the brain. It makes all the decisions, all the executive decisions for you. And so this part of the brain is the one that decides, am I really in danger or is it safe? You know, is that really a snake or is this twig that looks like a snake? And of course, in microseconds, your brain figures it out and tells you, oh no, it's just a twig, don't worry, you're fine. So it's a very, very important part of our brains. And of course, I could go on about all the things it does, but as far as this function, the fight or flight, those are the four parts of the brain. Those are the immediate responses, and it's what your brain does to protect you. All right, so when we were hunters and gatherers, right, you needed to have this to save your life. You needed to see the threats around you, and they were real physical threats, right? So it was a very, very important part of survival. And the quick responses that I'm telling you about, the instant responses, saved your life. You know, if you had to know how to respond immediately for it to, so you could, you know, survive. Now, today, we don't live out, you know, we're not hunting, we're not gathering, we're not in danger of lions and tigers and bears, am I? You know, we don't have that anymore. But the mechanism that our brain has, the structures are still there. So what happens today is the dangers we perceive, the dangers that we feel when we feel threatened, they're perceived dangers. They're not, you know, actual lions running toward us. And that's very, very important, because in this whole paranormal idea, you know, with ghosts, it was brought up over and over and over in the tour, you know, should we be afraid? Should we feel fear? The examples that were given, the testimonies, everyone felt afraid, right? There was this fear connected to it. So the important thing about this fight or flight, we still have it. Our brain's still wired that way. So when you feel afraid, when you feel anxious, it's your perceived danger. You know, you're sensing something is wrong, something is here to hurt me, and you respond accordingly, okay? So, and this is from a book that I read that talked about all about the brain. The author was saying how we can work ourselves into a frenzy. That's what anxiety is. You know, it's your mind telling you thoughts that lead you into a situation that produce anxiety, you know, anxiousness or panic for that matter. Okay, so, you can't really see that very well. Okay, so that's the first function of the brain to protect. You know, your fight or flight response. It will always, always, always kick in. And like I said, now and today, 21st century, your dangers are going to be perceived most of the time. You know, you do have to be careful. You know, if you live in neighborhoods that are dangerous, again, the brain's going to be perceiving. You're going to be looking, right? You're going to be trying to make sure you're safe. But most of us don't live in a situation where we have to physically watch out for our safety. Okay, the next thing I'm going to talk about is your brain's built-in mechanism to detect. Okay, we have an amazing brain, and the brain is constantly searching for patterns everywhere, all the time. Your brain will always be searching, even right now, even coming in here. You know, my husband and I have gone on cruises before. I was connecting all the different things of what it's like to be on a ship, what it's like, you know, your brain connects all these pieces. Why? Again, it's for survival, it's to protect, it's to build these safety nets so you can function in the world. Because if you didn't have these pattern recognitions, then everything would be new all the time everything would be dangerous. Everything would, you know, not fit into place. So I wanted to show you. I have some pictures. They're not. They don't look so great up here, but we're going to try anyway. Can you guys tell what that is? Anybody see? Okay. There's two men in the back, and they're riding horses by a creek. Yeah, but who, when they first saw this, immediately saw the faces? Okay. There's been a ton of research, you know, and the very first thing we recognize as human beings are faces. Infants as young as 6 months old can recognize faces and their own mother's face, which is very key to survival. So we will always, always, always look for patterns. I see faces in my marble when I'm taking a shower. I mean, I'm always seeing faces in everything around me. So I want to show you a couple more. I'm going to try and flash them quickly. Tell me what you see, and then we'll go back to it. What did you see? Okay. Who saw a demon face? All right. Now look closely at the photo. See if you can detect the different things in an actual picture. Can you see what that is now as you look more closely? Okay, it's two women with black hats facing each other, long dresses, and there's an archway on the top of a building. Do you see that now? Okay, but immediately your mind goes to the face. Immediately. You can't even think about it. It just, that's what it sees. It sees the face. Okay, here's another one. All right. This is an old one, but it's a classic one. So, who can see the young lady? Okay. Who can see the old lady? Okay. Who can see both? Yeah, some people can only see the young, some can only see the old, and some can see both. Patterns, patterns, patterns. We're always looking for patterns. Okay. So, let's see, did I skip one? I think there was one more in here. I think I might have gotten deleted. Okay, so anyway, the whole idea of patterns, it's very, very important. Our brain, and I've read studies and articles, your eyes and your brain together work like an incredibly fine-tuned machine. So your eyes are, you know, where the stimulus is coming from, and it's connecting to your brain, and it's telling it constantly all the patterns that you need to recognize. Patterns to keep you safe, patterns that are not safe, all the time. So this is built into you. Everything you do, there's patterns. And this goes hand in hand with the next thing that I'm going to talk about, which is schemas. Who here has heard of schemas? Okay. Okay, so schemas are mental patterns. That's patternicity, what I just shared with you, is where your visual, your eyes and the visual parts of the brain work together to find physical patterns. Schemas are psychological patterns, and we do this in life. Again, the biggest reason is for survival. So everything you do, I want to talk about this, everything you do begins with a thought. Everything. So every mental process you have, you know, they're triggered by thoughts and your emotions. And I have a couple of stories to tell you about the power of the brain, because I wish I had more time and I could go on an hour for any of these subjects. But, you know, your brain is incredibly, incredibly powerful. And it is very, very powerful in the sense of putting things together. And your mind, because it's, you know, the chemical reactions and, oh, I didn't show the synapse. But anyway. So I have a friend who was very, very sick and convinced he was going to die, convinced he had cancer. He went to multiple doctors. They told him he was fine, but he was losing weight. He could barely walk, and he said goodbye to his family, and he knew it was over for him. He just knew he had cancer. The doctors were wrong. And he was deteriorating rapidly and, you know, was ready to just wait for his death. He was very, very convinced that that was a problem. Luckily, one of the doctors who saw him, instead of saying, there's nothing wrong with you, said, why don't you go see a counselor? You know, why don't you just go talk to them about what you're feeling and your physical illnesses, and maybe they can, you know, help you figure out what's been going on. Well, he did, and it turned out his mother had died of cancer, and he was unable to go to the funeral and be with her. And so he internalized that, and it became a source of guilt for him, and he felt very, very terrible. And so he had held that in for years, to the point where he felt like he deserved to die too. And he needed to die of the same illness. This is all, you know, it's all mental. And the counselor was able to help him work through it, work through the guilt, work through all the emotions, change his form of thinking, his schema, and he is fine. He's completely fine. He recovered. He's fully, you know, back to normal. Very powerful what your mind can do. I have another story. When I was taking my master's program, our professor told us about a gentleman who, he actually had cancer, was diagnosed with cancer, terminal cancer, and they gave him 3 months to survive. That's it. He, you know, he was going to die in 3 months. It's over, you know. No hope. He tried all the treatments. He did everything he could. And so he decided that for the last 3 months of his life, he was going to do things that were enjoyable and fun. And he decided to rent every funny movie there ever was and laugh his way to death. That's what he said. He was just going to laugh every day until the day came because there was nothing else he could do. Well, the actual opposite happened to this gentleman, and he got better and better and better and better, and the cancer disappeared. So unexplainable. The doctors could not, these are true stories, could not explain what happened. They had no answers for him because he was, that's it. They had, you know, told him he was going to die. So he studied his own, he started his own realm of psychology, of the power of positive thinking and how your mind can actually transform your body. So, you know, your thoughts can cause you to panic. I don't know if anybody here has ever felt so scared that they feel a panic attack. That's happened to me once. And it was before I actually studied psychology and had my master's. But now that I've studied, I can go back and tell you exactly the thought processes that were going through my head that led me to that panic. You know, we were moving homes. I was home alone with my 3 little boys. My youngest was a year and a half. We had hired this moving company. And when they showed up to my door, they had this beat-up truck and, you know, 4 men who didn't speak English. And they looked really scary. And I thought, oh, my gosh. I'm all alone. There's these 4 guys in my house. I have my 3 little boys. And I just, the whole thought process started, and I panicked. My heart started beating really fast. My palms started sweating. I started getting lightheaded, and I thought I was going to pass out. And I thought, what am I going to do if one of these guys tries something and I'm here alone? And my husband was waiting for me at the other city. And it was a horrible, horrible experience. But I remember what I did is I picked up the phone and I called somebody and told them what I was feeling. And it helped me just bring it all back down. And I, as long as I could have someone on the phone, I felt like I was safe. Not that that made any sense at the moment, but it's your mind. Your mind can cause you to go into panic. Your mind, your thoughts. So everything starts with your thoughts, and it's really, really important that you guys remember that. So with that, you know, your mind forms patterns. They're called schemas. And you have a schema about everything, about marriage, about money, about health, about dating, about everything. You form schemas because as you're growing up, you put the patterns together. And depending on how you grew up and what culture you're in and your environment, you form these patterns, again, called schemas. And they control how you make decisions, and that's why it's really important. I'm going to share a few schemas with you just to kind of understand. I grew up, my parents are from Mexico. They were born and raised there. They got married and immigrated to this country. And my father was a very strict, very macho alcoholic. And I grew up with a lot of family. I have a huge extended family, lots of aunts and uncles, lots of cousins. And so I started picking up these patterns in the men I saw around me, and all of them drank. All of them, you know, of course, this is my child brain picking up these patterns. In my mind, they all drank, they all got drunk, they were all abusive, they were unfaithful, you know, and so I started putting this picture together, and it wasn't a very nice picture of men. And so for a long time, my schema of men was men are jerks. You know, I just, there is no way I'm going to give my heart or trust somebody, a man. There's just, that's what I grew up with. And unfortunately, it was all around me, so it kind of fed into that schema. Another schema I have about health, you know, my father is the kind of person that he will not go to the doctor unless he's literally on his deathbed. Will not. Just, and still to this day, will not. So we grew up kind of, you know, you get hurt, you just kind of deal with it and move on and, you know, take some tea or rub a little, you know, butter and salt on the wound, whatever. You know, you just deal with it. When I was in fifth grade, I was playing baseball with my brother and his friends, and a little boy who was tagging me had the baseball and rammed it into my wrist, which dislocated and cracked my wrist, and, you know, went home, showed it to Mom. It was black and blue and swollen, and she says, well, we'll wait for your dad to get home, and we'll see what we do. You know, show it to Dad, and he's like, if it doesn't get better in the morning, we'll take you to the doctor. You know, fifth grader, so I was 11. I had, you know, dislocated wrist and broken wrist, but my father just didn't think it was that big of a deal. So my schema is, you know, I grew up like you just have to deal with it, you know, don't be a baby. And it translated to problems later on because my expectations were that everybody dealt with when they were sick or hurt that way, you know, including husband and children. So not a very good thing when you have those schemas. But anyway, those schemas just make you or form your decisions in life. Okay, so now, okay, Coco, well, what does that all have to do with what we're doing here today in the paranormal? Okay, well, it means what did you grow up learning, hearing, thinking, seeing about the paranormal? You know, what was your experience as a child? I grew up with tons of ghost stories all the time. And to calm my little brother down, my mom would tell him that the witch lived up in the tree right in front of our house. And if he was bad, the witch was going to come and get him. You know, and my little brother believed it. So, you know, he calmed down most of the time. So I grew up with stories all the time, all the time. And it affects how you see and perceive things. For example, I don't know, was anybody here afraid of the dark when they were young? Okay. In my room, I had my bed, and there was a window and a tree, you know, this ominous tree always by my window. And I remember many nights, I'd lie down, and I'd look out at the window, and I'd see these figures, these shapes, you know. And then I'd panic, and I'd freeze, and I was trying to decide, do I get up and run and turn on the light to see what it really is? Do I, you know, run to my mom and tell her what I see? Do I just cover my eyes and pretend it's not there? Because of all of these stories all the time. You know, and then I finally get the guts to turn on the light, and it was my sweater bundled up over my chair that looked like a face. You know, so again, how you grew up, how you think about things, and how you put your patterns together will affect what you think about the paranormal. Honestly, I was, like I shared with you, pretty undecided. Like, I don't really know what to believe. I've never had an experience like Robert has, and my family has told me a ton of experiences. So I didn't really know, you know, what do you do with this? Psychologically, I think it's really important. And the reason I wanted to kind of teach you all the way your brain works is because everything you do, even now, and the decisions that you make or thoughts that you're telling yourself and patterns that you have. The wonderful thing is, because your brain has 15,000 connections per neuron, you can change it. So you can change the way you think. You can change those patterns and those schemas. And that's really powerful, and you can take that with you and use it for your life. How many here are single? Okay. Almost half. All right. Your schema will determine who you marry. So pay attention to your schema. And how can you tell what your schema are? Well, your expectations. It's very important who you decide. I knew one thing for sure. It was I was going to marry somebody who did not drink. I knew that. That was my schema. I was not going to marry someone who drank, period. I just wasn't going to, that, you know, because of my experiences. And it will affect who you decide to marry, you know, what you do. Your schemas affect your relationships, you know, everything. So I have a very powerful example, but I want to make sure that I'm not going to be offensive or cause somebody to panic or be afraid, but I want to show the power of the mind. Now, this is a story of a young girl who, a German girl, who claimed to be demon-possessed. Well, she didn't claim it. Her parents assumed that she was demon-possessed. There is very extensive video on her showing her as she's speaking as a demon. So I want to warn you, it's kind of like the TV, you know, these may be too graphic for some. I don't want to upset you. It's very, very intense, but I want to show you the power of schemas. When you believe something, your mind will act accordingly. So even today, let me give you an example. Coming to speak here, I'm really here because my husband thought I had something useful for you guys to hear. This is a completely out of my norm and out of my comfort zone. And right before I came up here, I started to get those thoughts like, oh my gosh, what am I doing here? And heroes in the faith are here. And, you know, I'm just, you know, nobody. And my heart started beating and my palms started getting, you know, I'm like, what am I doing here? Do I have, but it's your mind. So I had to regroup and say, okay, well, I have something to share I think can help you beyond this paranormal conference. Your mind is very powerful. It controls everything you do. And this young lady, let me tell you her schema. She grew up very religious, very Catholic. So you have very set, you know, very clear black and white rules of right and wrong and sin. And this young lady, this is, of course, known afterwards, this young lady got involved in a sexual relationship and soon after became possessed and carried this demon with her. So she said she had a demon. She would speak out, you know, that she had been taken over. Now, if you believe you have a demon in you, you will produce the actions that confirm that. Does that make sense? So I was just speaking to Arturo and Ana Rosa just last night over dinner, and there's actually a, you know, someone they know in 21st century, same exact scenario, and they finally got her some help, some psychological help. So you guys up for hearing this and seeing it? Okay. All right. Here we go. It's in German.
Thank you.
Okay, I know that sounds really, really scary. And it was hard for me to watch the first time. But this young girl was exorcised 67 times. Eventually, she died of dehydration in her bed. Her parents were sued for negligence because they never took her to a psychologist, psychiatrist, medical doctor to try to help her. You know, after what Doug shared and John shared, and you know, we've heard, but I completely believe this is psychological. I don't think there was a demon in her. I don't think I don't believe in demon possession. I'm not sure about ghosts, which is funny, but I don't believe in that. But she, her mind, and you know, as a studying psychology, what I can tell you is she felt enormous guilt for her sin and felt she needed to punish herself. She started doing really intense things, graphic things, very scary, you know, but it's a very, very sad picture of, you know, when your mind has lost control. And the reason we shared it was because your mind is very, very powerful. And if you know someone or have experiences where, you know, you feel that you're hearing voices or you're feeling anxiety beyond your control or all of these things that we've talked about, it's a chemical response. So there is something going on in your brain. It's a chemical reaction and something is triggering it. So, of course, because this is what I studied, my first, you know, response would be to get psychological help, to get someone to attend to it. And the woman who spoke last night, the psychologist, you know, a lot of what she shared, and she talked about affirmations and replacing thoughts and all of that, there's again, your mind is very, very powerful. And everything we've talked about here with paranormal, I'm not here to sway you one way or the other, but to just realize your mind can spook you, can scare you, can lead you to panic. And if you already have this schema, you know, how many here had a schema of growing up with ghost stories and, you know, oh, see, not that many. So it's not really that common. Just so you guys know, in Scientific America, they did a poll, and there's 97% of Americans believe in some form of supernatural, with, you know, from being superstitious all the way to what we've talked about, you know, here with UFOs, aliens, everything. So there's a huge percentage of individuals who believe in that. And the patterns, you know, that we look for, like superstitious things. If you, you know, do well in a race and you're wearing a certain shirt, you wear the same shirt again because you think that's going to help you win the race. Little things like that. So from the simplest to the biggest things. So it is a huge thing. I thank you for taking the time to listen to what I had to share. I hope it helped in some way. And my husband will do the second part, more intense.
Wow, great job. Wow, 67 exorcisms. It reminds me of the movie Napoleon Dynamite. How many of you saw that movie? Wonderful movie, right? I love it when his Uncle Rico buys the time machine because he wants to go back and become a pro football player. And so Napoleon Dynamite comes in the kitchen and finds it, and you know, they tell him to try it, and he puts it on his stomach, and it shocks him, and he says, "This is a piece of junk, it doesn't work." And I think, boy, the same could be said for exorcisms, right? 67 of them, I mean, didn't work at all. But I'd like to give you something that I think will work. So let me start off with a little story. Ever since I was a child, I always had a fear of someone under my bed at night. So I went to a shrink and told him, "I've got problems. Every time I go to bed, I think there's somebody under it. I'm scared. I think I'm going crazy." "Just put yourself in my hands for a year," said the shrink. "Come talk to me 3 times a week, and we should be able to get rid of those fears." "How much do you charge?" "$80 per visit," replied the doctor. I'll sleep on it, I said. 6 months later, the doctor met me on the street. Why didn't you come to see me about those fears you were having, he asked. Well, $80 a visit 3 times a week for a year is an awful lot of money. A bartender cured me for $10. Is that so? With a bit of attitude, he said. And how, may I ask, did the bartender cure you? He told me to cut the legs off the bed. Ain't nobody under there now. Boy, that works, doesn't it? So I'm going to offer you this option of just cutting the legs off the bed today. The classes have been wonderful. As John mentioned, Doug is very polite. John, very straightforward, but very respectful. I'm afraid I'm going to perhaps be a bit offensive, but hey, it's great to have, all different perspectives here, right? And then we can digest it all at the end. So let's talk about ghosts for a little bit. Let's see if we can cut the legs off of the bed when it comes to ghosts. All right, we're going to watch a ghost story, all right? This is actually not a story. This is CNN. So you've got to look very, very closely. Try to focus in. It is a bit disturbing, I'll admit. But go ahead and see what you can see. Larry King. You'll hear the sound in a minute. All right. Look back in here. Look very, very closely. You can see a shadow figure if you look. Did you see it?
Yeah.
All right, keep looking again. They'll get a close-up.
Yeah.
Look very closely. All right, they're going to do a close-up here. All right. Okay. Okay, how many of you jumped? All right. There's some odd things about ghosts, right? All right, maybe they're these dead people that walk around and, maybe they can do it. Let's put it on the table. I mean, hey, let's explore all things, right? It's interesting. The other option is that these are psychologically induced phenomena. So let's just look at some things. Let's see if we can try to use our reason and see which makes more sense. Some odd things about ghosts. Why do they appear to people only in scary places, like cemeteries, dark basements, or grandmother's creepy old bedroom? Why don't they show up in the middle of the day at football games and busy shopping malls? Could it be that these mechanisms in our brain that are fearful are producing some of the things that we might see or think about? Are ghosts stuck in the spot where the person died? If so, then why do they infest hospitals where most people end up dying? Could it be that busy hospitals with their bright fluorescent lights turned on 24/7 aren't creepy enough? It's an interesting thing to think about. That's where most people die. Why don't we see all the ghosts there? Now, in the creepy old abandoned mental hospital, there are lots of them, but not in the trauma center with doctors and nurses running around 24/7. You just don't see a lot of them there. Odd. If ghosts aren't stuck where the person died, then why aren't they roaming around the earth doing cool things like cramming onto the space shuttle or camping out in Tahiti? Why do the ghosts here have to stay on this old ship? Jump on a 747 and go to Buckingham Palace and have breakfast with the Queen. You could do it, right? Why are they stuck here? Is there like a invisible fence like those things? We used to have one of these things for a dog. If it would cross the fence in the yard, it would get shocked in the neck. It didn't work at all. The dog just ran across the fence, and then he got shocked, and then he just took off for miles. And we had to put signs up. Fortunately, we got him back. But maybe there's some kind of a perimeter fence, and you're stuck here. So if that's true, it's a wonderful place to visit, but I don't want to be stuck here. So if they're stuck in the dreary old house in Detroit, then what do they do all day? Perhaps ghosts can't have any fun, and they have some sort of a mission to accomplish, so they have to stay on task. Is floating back and forth in the dark room their task? That seems kind of trivial. How do they move? Do they walk or float? How far above the ground do they float? An inch? Why not float 20 feet above the ground? That would be more fun. Obviously I'm having a little fun here, but it just doesn't make sense. So where do all these ideas come from? I don't think they come from a rational analysis of what ghost phenomena are. I think that they come from folklore. Now, wait, We're Christians. It's unspiritual to be logical, right? Where's the wise man? Where's the scholar? Where's the philosopher of this age? Has God not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? Well, what's that talking about? Does that mean we just throw our reason out the door and we can see dragons or, hey, Jesus was an alien? I mean, anything you want to come up with. No, the beauty of Christianity is that it is a rational faith. It's a faith that's based on evidence. You know, we believe in the resurrection of Jesus, that he proved he was the Son of God by the resurrection because there is historical evidence to support that. Now, can you prove it absolutely like a scientific experiment? No, historical evidence doesn't work that way. But our faith is based on reason. Our beliefs are based on reason. That's what sets us apart. If not, you can believe just about anything you want to, and you know, you can try to present Christianity to people, and you're just throwing it into the mix with a lot of other superstitious beliefs. Christianity is very different. Now, John Clayton already showed you this image, talking about patterns. I mean, look at that. That really looks like a face. I mean, that is from an actual photograph of a spacecraft. It took a low-res image of this face. John, do you have the laser? Can you just keep it pointed on the... I'm sure everybody sees. All right, but look, this is a close-up now, high-res. There's nothing there. As Coco said, we see patterns. We'll put things together in a pattern. So, you can't convince a believer. This comes from a website. And listen, we are beginning to suspect that there are a whole bunch of things about Mars they have told us that aren't true. I think at this point we have to consider that the environment of Mars, the actual real temperatures, the density of the atmosphere, they may have lied to us about some of this stuff too. They may have wanted it to seem more of an inhabitable hell than it really is. You know, so you can't win. I mean, all those JPL scientists, you, Hoppy, you liar. He's a JPL scientist who studies Mars, and you're all a bunch of liars there. Gee, why are you feeding us this? You know, these lies about Mars, and they're covering up all the aliens, and, you know, I'm sure you probably experimented on them too. So you can't win. But it's just unreasonable. What do you want your beliefs to be based on? What do you want the foundation of your worldview to be? Well, we're Christians, and so certainly the Bible forms the foundation of our worldview. We do believe that it is the inspired Word of God, that God has reached out to His creation, mankind, and communicated to us through the Bible. He has revealed Himself to us through the Bible. So certainly that's the first place we want to look for answers. But, you know, sometimes the Bible is unclear about certain things, and sometimes it just doesn't tell us at all. The Bible did not tell us how to make penicillin. We had to figure that out. And a lot of people died from infections before we figured that out. It does not tell us how to build a space shuttle. You've got to figure that out. And it took thousands of years of accumulating scientific knowledge to learn about a lot of these things. And many of the people, even those who wrote the Bible, were ignorant of a lot of things that we're not ignorant about today. Just because they were inspired and wrote down a book of the Bible does not mean that they knew the earth was round instead of flat. It does not mean that they knew about the laws of thermodynamics. I mean, there are a lot of the germ theory of disease. Nevertheless, God communicated important spiritual teachings and moral teachings to us through the Bible. So that's certainly our foundation. But we're going to have to figure a lot of other things out too. And God has given us two wonderful tools, a brain and we got fingers. You know, a lot of animals have brains, some bigger brains than we do, elephants and dolphins and whales. But you know what? They don't have fingers. And you can't light a fire in the ocean. So there's no chemistry, no metallurgy, no iPhones, none of that. So, you know, we lucked out. We got fingers and brains. And we can do amazing things with that. And I think God encourages that. There's nothing wrong with that. That is what's so wonderful about God and this creation. We're free to explore and solve our problems. And God is not a helicopter parrot. micromanaging us at every second. Don't do that. No, stop. No, no, no. You're going to blow up the space shuttle if you do that. No, you know, we're going to have some accidents. We're going to make some mistakes, and God is letting us grow and develop as the human race. He's not constantly intervening, although sometimes he does intervene. We know that. But what about ghosts then? You know, what are we going to base our knowledge or our ideas on? Let's just take science first. What does science tell us about ghosts? Well, it tells us they don't exist. There's just simply no good scientific evidence to support the existence of ghosts. It's just not there. That's interesting. All right, what does the Bible say? Well, no good evidence that they exist, but it takes it a step further. They cannot exist. Theologically, it violates the teachings of the Bible, as Doug mentioned. So, they don't exist based on what science tells us. They can't exist based on what the Bible says. So guess what? No ghosts. They just are not. The legs are off the bed. There's just nothing that can be under there anymore as far as ghosts go. So no reason to be afraid of them. No reason to worry about, you know, looking for, are we communing with them? No, they just don't exist. No different than trying to commune with the Easter Bunny. They simply do not and cannot exist. So, that solves the ghost problem. How about demons? Perhaps a little more complicated. What does science tell us? They don't exist. There's no good evidence to show that demons exist. You won't find it in the scientific literature. What about demon possession? Like this, I don't know, that's clearly schizophrenia. And there are many, many cases of that are well documented. Now, imagine a person living 2,000 years ago that sees this. I mean, what do you think? Jesus is going to go say, well, actually, this is a case of schizophrenia, and this is a genetic disorder. 90% of the cases that have been studied in a controlled double-blind study have indicated that, it is caused by genetics and can respond to Risperdal and other psychotropic drugs. You know, like, what? You know, just cast the demon out. Jesus, he knew we were not ready. And so, science, certainly there's no good evidence for that. Now, what about the Bible? Talking about Jesus again and these, you know, incidences of casting out demons. Okay, does the Bible prohibit demons as these sentient beings? No, absolutely not. And your first impression is that, yes, there are these beings that can possess people. That's certainly what you get from the first reading. Is that absolutely right? Maybe, but there is another possibility. Perhaps a demon is simply an unseen force. It is simply a way for people in ancient times to express something that they didn't understand. They didn't know anything about the germ theory of disease. They didn't know anything about genetic disorders and schizophrenia or epilepsy. And if they see somebody foaming at the mouth and convulsing, you know, a demon seems like a pretty reasonable explanation based on the schemas that they had. Speaking in a different voice, people did that back then, too. Hey, those were the schemas they had. They didn't have access to our schemas. Well, now we have a very different way to put all this together. And we've got to ask, well, okay, but Jesus cast out. Why did he let them persist in their ignorance? As I just alluded to, is Jesus going to take a time out and give them a whole semester lecture to explain psychology, but they weren't even ready for that, because before you even study psychology, you got to learn how to read and write, which a lot of these people couldn't do. They simply weren't ready. You know, why didn't God, you know, teach them about psychology and mental disorder back then? Well, the same reason he didn't give the Ten Commandments to the Neanderthals. They just weren't ready yet. And so when people were ready, you know, God gives them what they need and what they can handle. And I think in the modern world, you know, we're very aware of how psychological disorders manifest themselves, and it certainly could look like demon possession. But based on all of the evidence we have from science, it is not. Based on what the Bible teaches us, it is certainly possible and permissible within the boundaries of faithfulness to God's word, to interpret these cases of demon possession as simply illness, physical illness or mental illness. For me, personally, that makes a lot more sense. So I don't have to worry about demons possessing me. I don't have to worry about demons wandering around in the halls of this ship. They simply do not exist as these beings that can take us over and, you know, cause us to, you know, lose control of our actions. You're going to have to obviously make the decision for yourself. I know I'm in a minority as I present these things, but the idea is that you have something to think about, and we'll have some great discussion later on tonight, and I certainly wanted to throw these ideas into the mix, and I'm very, very grateful for what my wife was able to share, and hopefully we can continue later with some great discussion.